isn't it just so wonderful to be so far above the fray, just looking down upon the minefield at the wreckage that's there and having no part of it? Wouldn't that be wonderful? It would be. Sadly, it would make a crap show, so we can't do that. But we are going to contemplate ivory towers today as we try to negotiate some of the ethical and moral terrain and dilemmas of modern life, and I suppose some of the animating ideas and philosophies behind our key institutions. That's, I think, where we're going today. Waleed Ali is my name. With me is my co-host, Scott Stevens. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Waleed. I was thinking for a moment you were going to suggest a program name change. That would have been quite nice. The Ivory Tower. That works pretty well for me.
You could argue that rather than a minefield, this is a bit of an ivory tower. It's an ivory tower laden with mines. How about that?
Well, look, it is interesting. When we think about ivory towers, one of the ideals, one of the institutions that's always been associated with that particular pejorative is the institution of the university. And, of course, university life, the responsibilities of universities, the public goals of universities, and even the aims of the university sector itself has been front and center of public debate throughout this year as the push to deregulate universities has really become a flashpoint for the federal government. We both kind of keep our, what is it, our big toes at least in university life. We often attend academic conferences. You yourself often keep engaging in classroom conversation and provocation.
Well, I should, in the interest of disclosure, I should actually say I am still employed by a university and I do still teach at a university.
Here's what I've been kind of questioning, I suppose. Here's what I've been wondering as I think about some of the great concerns that have been raised against university deregulation. I mean, the case, it seems to me, is quite a straightforward case. Let's just hear, for instance, from the way that Glyn Davis, Vice Chancellor of Melbourne University, this is how he frames, I suppose, the economic but also the social imperative why we need to revisit the structuring model that governs university life.
We got here because in 2012, we decided as a nation to have a demand-driven system where any qualified student could get a place in university. And that's, I think, a really important national decision, one strongly supported by the university sector, as by student organisations. But it's come at a very substantial cost. And successive governments, first the Labor government in the cuts of 2013, and now this government in the cuts announced in 2014, are saying that they can't or are not prepared to pay for the cost of the demand-driven system. And the crisis we now see, building on the chronic underfunding that Michael's outlined, is about how do we pay for the system where we've seen huge expansion in students coming to universities, and that's the crux of the problem we now face.
Now, this, it seems to me, is a very interesting way of framing what the issue is. So is the issue really about deregulation? Are the objections of student groups, some politicians, is it just we don't agree with the deregulated market? Or is it the concern that if the market, if the university sector is deregulated, if universities charge students what they believe it costs in order to offer the best possible programs that they can without simply allowing student numbers to balloon out, then what is the real concern? The concern is that students will be saddled with astronomical and exponentially increasing student debt to repay after university life, such that it then represents something like what's happening. This is something of the student debt crisis that's taking place in the U.S. now. Now, Waleed, what I'd suggest to you, and I'm really interested in you responding to this, my suspicion is if there is one overarching value, if there is one conviction that structures university life in Australia and that separates it from, say, universities in the UK and universities in the US, it's the presumption of egalitarianism. In other words, Australian universities are not elite institutions. They have to be open access and equal access institutions. And that, I think, it makes them very different and makes the debate here very different from what we see in the US and the UK. What do you think?
Where there is an elitism embedded within the very idea of the university, you mean?
Yes, and predicated right on the idea. And in fact, the elite status of certain universities is part of the attraction of going
yes
to certain universities.
I don't think that that aspect of it is actually not present in Australia. We have the Group of Eight, for example. We have these institutions that rank universities, that identify certain universities as the elite. Maybe they're the elite en masse, or maybe they're the elite within a specific area. You know, certain universities are associated at being the best in particular courses. I don't believe that the idea of the university as merely common is entirely reflective of the Australian attitude towards it. I don't believe that. What I do believe, and I think what Glyn Davis is getting at there, is that we believe that partly because universities do help create an elite, a cultural elite, perhaps even an economic elite and a political elite, because they help create that. There has to be equality of opportunity for access, so that even if the university is in some ways an institution of elitism, that elite bracket should be penetrable. It should be, it's a permeable border. It's not one that is determined simply and merely, or should not be one that is determined simply and merely by class or which school you happen to go to, or who your father is and how much they earned. Mm. That is the extent to which I would say that it's egalitarian. I'm not convinced, though, that it has yet come truly to mean in Australia that we believe absolutely anyone should be able to go to university. Mm. I think we're heading that way. I think there has been a really profound market-based logic that has come from universities but also been imposed upon universities to think of themselves effectively as corporations have to make money. And I fear the consequences of that. I think what that does ultimately is it opens the way to a logic that is about the battery farming of undergraduates and the desire to try to have as big a throughput as possible and thereby compromising the idea of elite education. I believe that's a concern,
okay,
but I don't yet believe that that is completely realised in the Australian imagination.
Okay,
so there.
Okay, well, okay, well put. But there is something else that's, I think, lurking beneath what you say there that I think actually proves what I'm trying to say. What you've just described is a university sector that no longer appeals to students on the basis of you will be a better person, you will be a better citizen, you will be a more equipped member of a civil and democratic society by virtue of coming to this university. Instead, the sales pitch of universities is you will be more employable if you come to us. If you go to University of Sydney, or if you go to University of Melbourne, you're going to be inherently more employable. This will be a more effective form of vocational training for you than if you go to, say, University of Victoria or University of Southern Queensland. In other words, there's already a presumption here that what universities are about is making people economically useful and productive within the larger workforce. And that, it seems to me, is already a change in the way that we think about the point of university life. And that, I think, Waleed, actually brings us back, if you would concede that point, that brings us back to the issue of what is behind university egalitarianism. Because everybody should have equal access to the workplace, not by virtue of their class or their wealth, but by virtue of their skills and their hard work. Universities should be and must be expected to be effective vocational trainers for the sake of the broader economy.
I'm prepared to concede that much. I think that the transformation of education into training, effectively, as, yes, as a vocational endeavour, I think has been a thoroughgoing process, hasn't it? I mean, that starts in high school.
Absolutely.
I mean, it doesn't quite start in primary school, although you could probably mount an argument if you really wanted to, but that starts in high school where students are being increasingly funneled into subjects that have a more vocational appeal. You start doing things like legal studies, for example.
Or even, as is the case in Queensland, by the time you graduate grade 10, you're funneled into a vocational path versus an academic path or an OP path.
Right. So this I'm prepared to concede. But what I'm a little bit sceptical of, and maybe our guest can help us out with this, what I'm a little bit sceptical of is the idea that the university as a creator of better people, better citizens, was a complete idea. Because would you argue, Scott, that it is the case, and it always was the case until this neoliberal logic sort of overtook the university sector, was it the case that we believed that those who went to university were necessarily more morally upright than those who didn't? Were there not other ways of conceiving of morality that were perhaps simpler and more grounded, but nonetheless equally compelling, and that that was really reflective of the moral logic that kind of undergirded society in a way that the economic logic of today undergirds our society?
Look, I suspect, Willie, the only way of actually answering that question, I mean, nobody would say that someone is simply morally better by virtue of having gone through university. But
right,
if you place certain disciplines at the top of the university hierarchy, in other words, this is the kind of structuring discipline. This is the discipline that helps all of the other disciplines make sense, that allows them to find their place within a broader vision of human life. Then that means, for instance, if you would say, put as has been done in the past, philosophy or
yep,
theology, God forbid, at the pinnacle of the hierarchy of disciplines, then those are the disciplines that make physics and economics and law and politics make sense. As soon as you put something else at that, at the peak, or some other value at the peak, then it by its very nature, it rearranges, if you like, it reconfigures the way in which disciplines themselves make sense, which means that disciplines themselves get detached from a broader end and they just become about making money or career advancement or something else. So I don't think it's just that by going to university you become a better person, but I think university is about, and historically has been about, the shaping of a fuller, richer, more broad and rich conception of life oriented towards some good that is beyond mere money-making or career advancement.
It's inculcating a broader ethos, a broader ethic, and subject matters that you might study fit within that.
Yes.
And if you don't have that, then what you ultimately end up with is a kind of siloed approach to the various disciplines.
Yes.
Physics is in that box, philosophy is in that box, sociology is in that box, psychology is in that box over there, and you have to work really hard to try to integrate them.
And then you also get the disciplines themselves failing to talk to each other. And so you have the atomization of the disciplinary approach to universities as well.
That, I agree, has happened. I am seeing movements the other way, which is interesting. Yep. I'm also intrigued by the way you said theology, God forbid. Now, I'm going to have to think about that paradox for a very long time. While I do that, let me reset. You are listening to The Minefield or The Ivory Tower. I can't decide which today. If you would like to leave a comment for us, tweet us at RN The Minefield. Scott and I have talked ourselves into a bit of a hole. I think we need someone to get us out of that hole. Scott, who is it?
Indeed we do. We're lucky today to have as our guest someone who has thought quite possibly at least as much as anyone else alive about the way in which the disciplines ought to be structured in the university, but also the extent to which the university can help with allowing students to appreciate and understand the good life. Miroslav Volf is Henry B. Wright Professor of Systematic Theology at Yale Divinity School and the founding director for the Yale Center of Faith and Culture. He's got a book coming out in the next few months called Flourishing, and one of the more interesting aspects to me, Miroslav, is the material that you devote in that book to higher education itself. So here's what I wanted to, I suppose, put to you. I mean, is it fair to say that within American university life, in North American university life, which is, I suppose, the context that you know best, that it is the money-making disciplines, or it's the disciplines that will guarantee students most profitability in later life, that they have become almost the guiding forces within the university ecology as a whole?
I think that's certainly true. I think there's kind of one strand in universities that is about making money, and that which will skill understanding, which will make it possible for you to make more money, has more prestige in the university. There's also a sense that universities continue to be kind of descriptively explanatory explanatory endeavors, for instance, physics or something like that, hard sciences. So you've got this kind of dual almost purpose. One is to explain how the reality functions, and the other was in order to kind of manipulate reality to achieve ends that we set for ourselves. Mm. And that happens to be right now making money, improving the state of the world in some tangible way. And these disciplines then of instrumental rationality and explanatory rationality tend to dominate.
But even the explanatory rationality disciplines, they have a kind of public-private partnership appeal. In other words, they seem to feed more directly into research deals that a university might strike up with whatever company it might be.
They end up being always kind of directed toward technology, right? Mm-hmm. The new technologies or something of that sort. That's quite right, right?
Or grants from government. I mean, 10 years ago, the best way to get a grant was to undertake a research project in terrorism studies. These days, maybe climate change might be a better option, depending on which government you're dealing with. There is that kind of interrelationship. It's, I suppose, making things more pragmatic than they are theoretical or ethical. But, Miroslav, I wonder if the difference then between what we are observing now and what Scott is describing is that one might be concerned with creating something that's more the social, the public, the shared good or benefit. On the other hand, creating a better society, whereas Scott's trying to describe university as a process that was once about creating a better self. Is that a meaningful distinction or is that too simple?
Yeah, I mean, it may be. I think it's a kind of nature of the self and nature of society that we have with you. In a sense, you can say that a kind of this instrumental rationality makes a better self, in a sense, more efficiently functioning self in a larger kind of public sphere. And I think that what has fallen away on the wayside is a kind of deeper reflection on who human beings are, what their place in the universe is, and kind of reflection on the competing accounts of what I would call competing accounts of the good life. And we have multiple competing accounts within single tradition, like the Western tradition. There are kind of plurality accounts of the good life. And then when you add to this in the globalized world, other religious traditions as well. And it seems to me that for the character of the self, but also for participation of individuals and people in a larger society, it's very important for us to reflect on these issues, learn how to converse in a compelling way with others who disagree, and then formulate the kinds of ends that we desire our societies more broadly to pursue.
So let me tease that out just briefly then, because I wonder if what we're actually observing, Miroslav, is just the philosophical expression of modernity. Aren't we? I mean, if you look at, you spoke about the explanatory disciplines, the physical sciences, you can add the social sciences to that. But what is sociology, as an example, other than an attempt to reduce all the complexities of social life to mathematical-like equations with variables that we can somehow measure and then try to explain in some quasi-scientific way? Isn't the ultimate goal of sociology, the kind of utopian vision of sociology would be that social problems are reduced to more or less technocratic equations that we can then solve? And that is just in turn an extension of positivism, the underlying philosophy of modernity. In which case, I wonder, is the vision of the good self, the good society that Scott is talking about, actually one that is a bit nostalgic for us living in modernity, because it's actually a pre-modern vision that hasn't really been realized ever since positivism gripped the public imagination?
You could say that, but I don't think that will be, at least in my judgment, that wouldn't be a compelling argument, because there is an account of the self that's being always presumed in the kinds of descriptive things that we, the descriptions that we give to society, or in the particular ways in which we have organized society. Think about capitalism, for instance, right? It's not that it's kind of neutral tool to achieve an end that we have set for ourselves, but rather there are all sorts of values, accounts of who the self is that are embedded in capitalist market economy. Think of a person as a responsible individual agent. You think of a person as being motivated by calculus of cost and benefit, or things of that sort. You presume limits of a market or no limits of a market. So there's a multiplicity of ways in which we make moral judgments always in what we seem to think as are simply facts of how things function.
Okay, but here I think we've actually reached the nub, or the really sticky point, with modern liberalism. I'd put to both of you that one of the things about modern life is that because liberalism is not a social and political space within which people's desires, ends, dreams, destinies can be adjudicated. They can't be judged. No, that's good, that's bad, that's legitimate, that's illegitimate, that's a base goal, that's a sort of a more superior goal. Because these desires can't be adjudicated, they just have to be granted. And then what university becomes about is the most efficient way for you to get what you want. But what universities then neglect is any kind of chastening interrogation about, well, what ought humans really to want? So, you know, despite what the two of you might think, I'm actually not trying to advance some kind of theological sort of, or even theocratic goal where we actually teach people what they ought to want. But even within secular philosophy, from Hume onwards, there's been a rigorous interrogation about what is a proper goal for humans to pursue. It's that lack of interrogation about what is worthy of pursuit that has been kind of, if you like, whited out or airbrushed out of university life. And so it's simply how's the best way of getting what you want, rather than higher reflection on what is it to want the best, rather than just what I want.
No, I fully agree with you. I think that's one of the reasons why I have started teaching at Yale a course aimed at undergraduate students. This has nothing to do, I'm a theologian, but this course has nothing to do or little to do directly with theological vocation. Course is called The Life Worth Living, and it is an attempt to help students think through the aims of the good life, the character of the good life, as it is expressed in multiple strands of philosophies and religions, and put these in conversation with one another, which is exactly asking the question, not so much what our desires should be, but in the sense of what is the kind of value framework in which we make decisions about what ought to be pursued, what is desirable.
Miroslav, how is that different, though, from what, for instance, of another philosopher like Martha Nussbaum has been arguing? I mean, outside of a kind of theological frame of reference, she's saying that essentially universities, broader democratic life, she's really tapped into the civic humanist tradition that says that democracies demand tremendous commitment, tremendous virtue on the part of their citizens in order to function properly. So she's saying that universities cannot do without the humanities, because what you've just described is the work that's done, for instance, in literature departments by reading some of the great texts of modern literature. There's a degree of that formation of empathy. There's a kind of self-critical awareness. There's the ability to read the narrative of oneself. I mean, do we really need philosophy, theology for this, or could compulsory undergraduate literary education do some of the work that you're suggesting?
I think some of the work could be done, but in some ways you can imagine what Martha Nussbaum is suggesting as kind of reflection on kind of help to the procedural character of democratic endeavor, right?
So I imagine it's still just proceduralist.
You need certain emotional intelligence about it. You need to put yourself in a situation of other people, and then you can function much better, not just in a broader society, but also in your companies and so forth. What I'm asking, and what I don't see Martha Nussbaum highlighting as much, but what my colleague at Yale, Anthony Kronman, is on the about educations, and that is kind of the goals of human beings. What is it that we ought to pursue? What does it mean for us to succeed as human beings rather than to succeed in this or that endeavor?
Mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting point you raise, Scott, and I would agree that you've provided an accurate description of the problem, which is, I suppose, either a consequence or a cause of this siloing of knowledge. I can't quite figure out which. But one thing that's interesting about this is the way that ethics still remains part of the disciplines that you learn within those silos. So if you study law, you will still come across those philosophical questions. What is the purpose of law? What are we trying to achieve? What is the vision of the good society we're trying to realize? What are the ethics of a lawyer and of a legal system? These things get discussed. Maybe all we need is for those ethical conversations that exist and have grounding in much grander theories somehow to be married up with the grander theory as something that exists in its own right, rather than as something that's a subset of a discipline.
I think that's quite right. It's not sufficient to simply think in terms of grander theories, but it's not certainly sufficient simply to think in terms of how do we resolve ethical issues and problems that arise. Generally, they tended to, at least in the United States, to be either in schools of management and sometimes schools of law. They tend to be reduced to legality. So
or
the moral
codes of conduct.
Codes of conduct that is within the legal bounds, right? And I think that's not sufficient.
Mm. Yeah, although the codes of conduct doesn't quite capture the kind of ethical education that they do offer within these disciplines. But I take the point that you're making, and I think there is a certain half-realized element of it.
But in the case, I think that's right, Willie. It's not certainly codes of conduct, but codes of conduct don't quite describe it. But I think it is the idea of an ethics that is particular to that particular vocation rather than something
that's technocratic for that reason. Mm. Yes, I understand. We are out of time, and Scott's made us even more out of time. You see what he did there, Miroslav? It's just not fair. Miroslav Volf was our guest today. Henry B. Wright Professor of Systematic Theology at the Yale Divinity School and Founding Director of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. Scott, that brings us towards the end. Any closing remarks as we head off into the sunset?
I would like people to let us know, do you vote for the Ivory Tower song to become our new theme? I'm giving my substantial vote yes.
Yes, and the show will henceforth be called the Ivory Minefield Tower. That's the aim. That's what you're going to be voting on. We look forward to hearing from you via Twitter or on our website. Until next week, this has been The Minefield. We'll see you soon.
You got the whole world in your hands.
ABC News Digital, giving you access to news from here at home and around the globe.
Home, you got the whole world.
When news breaks, the ABC puts the biggest stories in your hands when you want them. All from Australia's most trusted source, abc.net.au/news.
The whole world in your hands.